Okay, we were at Merchant of Yonkers.
Okay, so he was at the drama department in the spring of 1946, was going to do Merchant of Yonkers.
Who wrote that?
Written by Thornton Wilder, which later became The Matchmaker, which later became Hello, Dolly.
Oh, wait a minute. Matchmaker, that's right.
And then became Hello, Dolly. And the Merchant of Yonkers was the original show. And Thornton Wilder was a good friend of Henry Fetcher's. And he had a summer theater in Cohasset, Massachusetts, where Thornton Wilder had done some of his early work. So he had the script. So we did it. I had a real good part, and as a matter of fact, the part I had, I believe, was really a very presentational part. You sort of came out on stage and talked directly to the audience, and Henry would let me sit on the edge of the stage. He'd even let me go up to the people in the front row. So I really wasn't part of the show. I was more a commentator of what was happening, which was later cut out by when the show was redone. That part was sort of gone. But at any rate, I went back and I thought, boy, this is sort of nice. All my friends are here, and everybody wants me, so I said, okay. So I went and did all my paperwork the next day at the Veterans, and I then went back to Carnegie and never did get to Yale. But also in the play, The Merchant of Yonkers, was a woman who later became my wife. It was Lucy Seibert, S-E-I-B-E-R-T. S-E-I-B-E-R-T. So she had a small part in it, and although we weren't particularly friendly at the time, that's for the first time I really ever met her. And so I stayed in school that remained part of that semester, and then I took two more full years at school until I was graduated in May or June of 1948. And I never did even attend my graduation because Henry Betcher, who along with Fred Burley, do you remember him?
Fred Burley.
B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H.
B-U-R?
L-E-I-G-H. He was the... really the first and most lasting director of the Pittsburgh Playhouse from about 1936, except for his war years. He was there until the late 50s. So the two of them owned a theater in Cohasset, Massachusetts.
I saw that Cohasset.
C-O-H-A-S-S-E-T. It's about 22 miles south shore of Boston.
So Burley and...
Fetcher.
That's your own thing.
So when I was graduated, they asked me to come up and do publicity for them because I had done a couple of shows at school on the outside of the department. They were, in those days, were called Scotch and Soda shows. I think they still exist. It was like the Mask and Wig. It was like the Princeton Triangle, except we did not do the men and women's roles. But it was a student production away from the drama department. And some great people performed in it over the years. In fact, I saw one just recently. One of the first writers and directors of it was a Pittsburgher named Bob Finkel, who was a big Hollywood producer. In fact, I just saw him a week ago. Saturday he was in town. So we used to do these shows at Carnegie Music Hall. And I remember in my senior year, well, I wrote it in my junior year. I wrote a show with a fellow student and musician named Ken Welch, W-E-L-C-H. And I'll get back to him later. But and the following year, I produced the show at Carnegie Music Hall for Scotch and Soda. And in those days, I remember I was frightened to death because I was in charge of a $10,000 budget. And I thought, how dare you be in charge of a $10,000 budget. You have no idea what to do. I can remember panic-stricken, standing in the shower for hours, saying to myself, you better get out of this. You don't know how to manage $10,000. Anyhow, the show went, and we made money on it. That show was written by another student named G. Wood, initial G, and then Wood. And he's an actor. I guess his biggest thing you might remember him from, he played the original general in the movie MASH. He's a wild man, sort of bald-headed. Anyway,
did you ever talk about the name of the show?
The Scotch and Soda show? The one I did in 47 was called Rock, R-O-C-K, apostrophe, and Rock and Riot. They all used to have the liquor names in those days. They were all, that was for Rock and Rye, which was a drink. following year, I forget what it was called, but we got rid of the liquor titles at that point. They used to have titles like Have One on Me, with strings.
They were reviews, is that
correct? They were reviews. Yeah. But my last year, we did a sort of a book thing. And as a result of having done all the publicity and promotion for it, then Henry Betcher and Fred Burley said to me, why don't you come and work for us at Cohasset, Massachusetts, and as publicity director. And I did, and I missed my own graduation because I was working. And I'll never forget, Henry Betcher came in on a Sunday morning and said to me, I give you your degree, and you pretend to move my tassel from one side to the other. So I never did go to my graduation because I was working in the theater. It was a summer theater, and it was great in those days. They worked the town hall. In Cohasset today, there's a musical tent operation called the South Shore Circus. But when we were there, they played in the town hall. And I worked with stars. Like the first one was Jean Parker, who was an old movie actress, very beautiful woman. Some fun working with her. Names like Ruth Chatterton, well, this really goes back. The one who did I Remember Mama. No, before Peggy Wood, there was another woman. Well, I can't remember. But, the whole thing, Miriam Hopkins, these kinds of, they were mostly either aging movie stars or something like that. They would go out and work the summer circuit, and Victor Moore and William Gaxton.
Oh, my God.
And my last,
the
really...
One, the last one, I'm sorry.
Gaxton, G-A-X-T-O-N. He did all his early...
William.
Yeah, William Gaxton. He did of the I Sing, you know, the Pulitzer Prize thing by the Gershwins. And so, well, that's the last show I ever did in my life. I was in Betcher, I think, or Burley. One of them put me in. They needed somebody to round out the cast of Seven Keys to Bald Pate. It's an old mystery by George M. Cohan. It was a real stinker.
Seven Keys to Bald Pate.
B-A-L-D-P-A-T-E.
Bald Pate. Bald Pate.
Yeah.
Okay.
B-A-L-D.
Bald Pate. P-A-T-E. Like no hair on the head. And
that's so Cohan?
George M. Cohan, rather. Yes.
And that was a Pulitzer Prize one?
No.
Was that a music?
No, it was just a dumb mystery. And William Gaxton, who was by this time an older man, and he didn't really care an awful lot. I think he was pretty well fixed. And in fact, at that time, he had a cosmetic line out, which was very strange for 1948, and it was called Of the I Sing. And he was making lots of money from that, lived very big. And I was put in the show with him, and a couple of people from Carnegie Tech that were up there working. So I knew people, but it was a horrendous experience. First of all, the man would never stick to the script, and he would always try to, you know, get you in embarrassing positions. And I said, when this show is over, I'm going to sell that stupid makeup kit that I've been carrying since before the war, which I never did. I still have the makeup kit, but I never really acted again in the play. That did it. That washed me up. I just so hated, like they used to say, you can be an actor as long as you're subjective, but if you're objective, you're through. And I think one day I said to myself while doing the show, what am I doing standing up on this platform in somebody else's clothes with this goop on my face? And the minute you think that way, you no longer can act, because you're looking at yourself instead of the character. So I knew my career as actor was over. It's the last time I really was ever in a play. And then after that season, in which I had a great time. Ruth Chatterton was a character. I remember she had a big Italian sports car. She drove me to Boston, I think 21 minutes to go 22 miles, you know, and
wow.
It just scared me. And she was a pilot. And there were just some, you know, strange experiences all summer working with those people. Came back to Pittsburgh for a short while.
Now this is what year?
48.
48, okay. Right, okay.
And in the meantime, from my Army shows and doing things, I got a couple of nibbles to become a performer, nightclub comic type thing. And there were a lot of guys that came out of World War II that became comedians. And I was a fair one. You know, I did all right. And so I started to look into it. And I made a trip to Philadelphia, and some man offered me a television show, which seemed ridiculous in 1948. I mean,
what was his name? Remember?
An Italian name, and I have no idea anymore. But he had a performing agency. Mm-hmm. I think he was booking me and strippers into Wilmington, Delaware. I don't know. And I talked to him, and I thought, gee, I don't really want to do this. We'll put you in the Club 500 in Atlantic City. That's where Martin and Lewis got their start. And I thought, I don't really want to work saloons. I don't really want to be on the road. And in those days, to be a fair, successful performer, a la Danny Thomas, Don Rickles, they all sang and danced. Cope, they all sang. And I know that I really could not sing. I was practically tone deaf, and I had no rhythm or no desire to even want to learn how to do it. So I figured there were no top comedians in those days. Today, they're mostly all top comedians. So I thought, this is not for me. So I went back and forth. And then a friend of mine from Carnegie in the early days, prior to the war, was a little man who looked like Oscar Levant, and he was a pianist himself. His name was Lee Goldman, out of Cleveland. Goldman. He changed his name to Lee Lawrence professionally, and he had a little film company, and through some friends, he said, whatever happened to me, and he invited me to come to New York and work for him. And we were one of the first companies to go out and sell television commercials. It was called Lucid Art, L-U-C-I-D, Art. And I was a salesperson for him, and would go to advertising agencies. And we made the first Ballantine beer commercial. Milk Industry Fund, yeah. And we worked for the Milk Industry Foundation, and we were able to do shows live and on film. The kid had a brilliant idea. He used to work silhouettes, and behind the screen, anybody could play anybody, and if you were a milkman, you had a two-dimensional prop that looked like you're carrying bottles. If you were a streetcar conductor, you had a hat. And so we were able to use actors back and forth while you did things around it. And then we were able to do the show live. So I remember going to Atlantic City for the Milk Industry Foundation and doing the same show live. And the man, Jason Lee, L-E-I-G-H, who used to have the big signs on Broadway.
In Times Square?
Times Square, yeah. With all the silhouettes in it. He was crazy. He couldn't figure out what we were doing, because every time he did it, the silhouette screen had a frame around it, and when people stood behind it, their feet were gone. And the only secret to it was that this kid put a platform behind it so that the feet were visible. I think the man drove himself crazy trying to figure. He wanted to buy the company just to find out how we showed the feet. So I did that for a while, and eventually it started to not work. And I did everything. And we worked out of his apartment. I babysat his children.
Now, this was in New York.
Mm-hmm. And then I moved in with a couple of Carnegie Techers. One who has just passed away. He was a great comedian, but he got the advertising agency business for his whole life. He's the one that said, "Look, Ma, no cavities." That's his campaign.
What was his name?
Ernie Motyl. M-O-T-Y-L.
Ernie?
Motyl. M-O-T-Y-L. He was from Tenafly, New Jersey. But he and I stayed friends. He just died about a year ago. And our other roommate was Bill Funhurst, that you might know, who was head of the Civic Light Opera here for some 20 years. Bill Funhurst.
See, I'm not a Pittsburgh.
Oh, you're not a
Pittsburgh. Marianne.
What is it
there? Bill Funhurst. T-H-U-N-H-U-R-S-T. He's back in Pittsburgh. He lives in Oakmont now. But he headed the Civic Opera from about 1971 until quite honestly, he got mixed up in a love triangle and the woman shot him in the face. But
wow.
Other than that, it's been a quiet career.
Is he dead?
No. He's fine.
How long?
Been married twice since.
How long has he been subject light off? 1971?
71 until about 84, 85, something like that. I'm still on their board, so I have to think. But anyhow, we roomed together in New York, and then he was in the original, Thunderhurst was in the original South Pacific.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we used to go hang out there, and he did another show, Herman Wouk show called The Traitor. My friend Checo at that time was in a show that had a lot of Pittsburghers called Lendoneer, which was written by a guy from the Playhouse. So at any rate, during that period of time, I did many things in New York. Then I even got a job once as a gag writer for two horrible press agents that looked like they came right out of Sweet Smell of Success, that book, you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were just sleazy, cruddy, gossip monger type press agents who would get your name in by hanging out in restrooms and getting information that they would slip to Walter Winchell and Ed Sullivan and so forth. And then for every tip, they'd get your name in, or your name in, because they were doing you a favor. So I wrote jokes for them, and I auditioned for this lousy job by having to go home and write jokes. And then I never heard from them again, and then one day I picked up the New York Post, I guess, and it happened on a Sunday night, and I turned to Ed Sullivan's column, and I said, right at the top was my joke. And they had changed it to Vivian Blaine, who at that time was doing the lead in Guys and Dolls, was one of their, said she knew spring is here because she saw two salmon swimming up the bond sign to spawn. That was the horrible joke, and I called the next day, and they said, did you see Sullivan's column? I said, yes. So they said, well, come on in. So they gave me a job, which wasn't a great job, but I did it for several months. And during that time, I would take items and little gags up to Dorothy Kilgallen and Ed Sullivan, and I sat at their store club with Walter Winchell one night and did all that horrible stuff. And then a friend of mine opened a back records business in New York.
Back records?
Yes,
old records.
Yeah, old
okay.
It's called BAC.
Okay.
Business Archive Center, and he had a great idea how to store old records, and I did all his PR. And I was with him, and I probably could have stayed with him, and the company became a very large one. In the meantime, I got a telegram one day and said, would you come back to the Pittsburgh Playhouse to be publicity director? And I thought, you know what, I don't really like New York, and I don't care what I achieve or don't achieve, it's going to be tough, and I'd like to go back. So I went back, and remember we quibbled over the job. They wanted to pay me $45 a week, and I sent them a telegram and said, 50. So silly, the telegram cost more than the raise. But
what year was it?
1949.
Okay.
And so I made a deal with them, and I came back here in like August or September of 49 and started working at the old Pittsburgh Playhouse, which was then under the direction of Fred Burley, that we mentioned earlier. Dick Hoover was the general manager, and I was publicity director.
Now, was that at the location now?
Same location.
At Kraft.
But they did not have a second theater,
which
was still the Tree of Life Synagogue.
Right, right.
And I was there during those negotiations when we bought it. So I went back and I started working at the Playhouse and really enjoyed myself tremendously from the beginning. The job was lousy, but I put in long hours and I really had a good time. And just about the time I got comfortable, somebody from Carnegie Tech called and told me about a job. They were interested in me in Rutgers.
New Jersey,
to do public relations.
Rutgers.
Yeah, so I went to look at it and spent some time there, and they offered me the job, and then I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, maybe it's the way to get back into New York. You did all the work in New York. And so I came back, and I told the Playhouse, so they equaled the pay.
So that
was
more.
Went all the way up to $75. So anyway, I stayed at the Playhouse. And then that year, this friend that I had mentioned earlier named Ken Welch, who was a musician and drama student and a painting and design student, he was everything. He's a wonderful composer In fact, he still is a producer in Hollywood with his wife, and she's from this area, Mitzi Welch. He was the one that actually discovered more or less Carol Burnett. And one of his, her first numbers was a number of his, I Made a Fool of Myself Over John Foster Dulles.
You're kidding. Yeah, oh, I love it.
So then he wrote for her all the time. She had her television shows. Anyway, he and I wrote a show called 50 Grand in the spring of 1950. And it was a 50, G-R-A-N-D. And it was a show that had a... It was a review, but it had a plot line to it. And the gimmick was that a baby was born at the stroke of midnight in the year 1900, and you follow this person through grade school and through courting and through marriage and through Niagara Falls, honeymoon, and through the Depression years up to the 1950 time. Everything else changed, but she stayed constant. I mean, she was the same person from a little baby in a crib to a mature mother, grandmother. Anyway, we wrote the show, and they produced it at the Playhouse, and it looked like it was real good. Everybody suspected we really had done something. Now, we had done a college show, so we had some experience with each other. And although we wrote together all day, we were never that friendly. I mean, I'd go off by myself in the evening, he'd go to the movies somewhere, I'd go somewhere else. But we worked together well. And 3 days before the show ever opened, we sold it to a Broadway producer, well, to a producer who was going to take it to Broadway. He was a man from Chicago. And we thought, I was 24, and I thought, this is simple. It's all you do. And I signed with William Morris Advertising. Agency in New York, and we were making advanced option money. I remember my father couldn't believe it because I said to him, may I borrow your charge because I'm going down to buy some clothes at Hughes and Hatcher.
I don't have a Hughes and Hatcher.
And he said to me, all right. So I borrowed his credit card. And went down. My dad used to always pay cash, you know, everything. The bill came in, they paid it right away, or he took the money. And I ran up this big amount, he thought, a couple $100, I guess. I bought a suit and a jacket. I remember I came home and said, do you think you can afford all this? I said, oh, yeah, I was on my way to big time. So anyway, the show, somewhere in the midst of all this, I sort of forgot my mother and father had one. But anyway, we wrote the show, and it was purchased. We got advanced option money, and then we had cast this young woman that I was friendly with from Carnegie Tech, and our romance had gone up and down over 40 years or more, in and out. But Kenny and I decided Lucy Seibert would be perfect for the show. So we got her in the show, and she was great. And the producer wanted her to go with the show in the lead, and the rest of them he would cast out of New York or so. Anyway, based on all that and my trips back and forth to Chicago for auditions and everything else, Lucy and I decided we were going to get married. We got married, much to disillusionment and upset and features of my parents because she was not Jewish, and it was a rough one. And we went to, and the show was, the man who bought it in Chicago was a man that had all the advertising agency work for Minute Maid. He had a lot of money. He had never produced the show. He had done the college inn shows at the Hotel Sherman. He had done a lot of those. But he had never done a big Broadway show. His idea was to incorporate the show in Illinois, open in Chicago, and run it there first, and then take it to New York, reversing the formal procedures. And after wasting much money and much time, they didn't really know how to incorporate a show in Springfield, Illinois. So after doing all this, he finally went to New York, and in Albany, they did it in 48 hours because they knew how to do it. By this time, he had used up most of his money. The show never got on. So if it had gotten on, I probably...
You wouldn't be here.
Yeah, well, I probably would have had enough establishment of name that I could probably have worked as much as I wanted to. And the money I would have made even from that show was staggering. Even by today's standards.
What year was that?
1950.
Okay, and is that the year you were married?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We were married in August of that year.
Okay. Okay. Now, we'll just go on until the tape runs out.
Sure,
no, that's okay.
No, but he wants to leave at 10:30.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
okay. Well, it's only 5 after 10.
Yeah.
You said you have... Are there other things about your parents that you want to say?
Yes.
Mentioned.
Well, anyway, that was a very difficult adjustment for them and for me and for Lucy, and we knew it from the beginning. We were both old enough at that time, I think 25, and I was almost 26. So we weren't exactly kids, and in those days that was older than you, 25, 26 is today, I think. And we talked this over from every angle, and we knew it was going to be difficult, we knew it was going to be tough. But we decided we wanted to do it, and that we would, as we once said, we could, if we were the same religion, we could probably fight 6 days a week and get along on the seventh. This way we'll get along 6 days a week and we'll fight on the seventh. So based on that, we swallowed whatever problems we had, and we've been able to work that out. It was very difficult for my parents, especially my mother. My father was much more understanding, if that's the word for it, and went through many things, and I think as part of this history, this is probably a kind of thing to really discuss, because it was very strong in those days. Not that it's probably any less strong today, but I think today it's maybe handled in a different way. But there, that was complete disown, out the door. And I did not come from a really strictly Orthodox family. I mean, it was not... In fact, if I had, I probably would have had less trouble, because it had been more emotion, and this was more logic, and they just didn't want it. My grandmother, who was still alive, the maternal grandmother, she was very kind and very good about it. My father was pretty good. My mother wasn't. And I remember old Rabbi Lichter, I don't know if you remember him or not, from B'nai Israel. He even came and spoke to them and with me, and then I left, and he said, well, you've done what you can do, so don't worry, that's it, you know. So it was tough, and so when we started having children, it was difficult. And after a few trips to my house, my wife really just didn't go anymore, because it was too difficult for everyone. But the kids always went over, and I took them over. And the kids were funny, they knew exactly the situation, and you know, they would say lines like, on the way over there, kids, don't say that you got that sweater for Christmas, because you'll upset Grammy Krantz. So then the kid would say, my mother would say, that's a lovely red sweater. Where'd you get it? I got it for Christmas. Oh my goodness. So they always had problems, but the kids, they lived through it and understood it. And they're fine, I think, you know.
Okay, can we talk about the kids? How many? Yeah. When were they born? How old? Their names?
We have three boys, and the first was born in 1952, March 9th, 1952. His name is Mark.
M-A-R-K?
M-A-R-K.
March?
March 9th, 52. And in December 11th of 54, Steve. And in June of 11th of 59, Daniel, Danny.
1959.
Yeah, so those are the three kids.
Daniel?
Mm-hmm. During the early years, my wife continued to work in the theater. She had been to New York twice in her life after her sophomore year, and then her parents dragged her back and made her finish school. Then she went again and worked varied jobs, but Bonnie gave it up and came back. But she worked in Pittsburgh. She must have done a dozen shows at the Playhouse, did several Civic Light operas in the summer, and a lot of children's theater. And even as a young woman, I'm going to regress here for a minute, as a young woman, she went to Taylor Alderdice High School. And she, from the 7th grade through 12th grade, worked for the Pittsburgh Children's Theater. And you remember Grace Price Katz, who had a Price Katz, and her husband had a big department store in Keysport. She had this children's theater, and she treated Lucy like a daughter. And Lucy acted for her for 5 years before she ever went into Carnegie. And I have a feeling that Lucy burned herself out, you know. By the time the kids were born, she had had the theater. She'd been in it for 25 years by then. But she acted at the Playhouse even after I left. And she did some civic opera after I left. And then she did another children's theater. So she stayed active until the third child. And then she pretty much kicked it. But our kids today are...
Wait one second. Yeah. So Lucy's also a Pittsburgh.
Well, she wasn't born here. She was born in a place called Cowdersport.
Cowdersport.
And she was raised partially in Pennsylvania. And she was raised by, her grandparents lived in Wellsboro, which is where the Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania pretty. But she came here, they moved to Squirrel Hill when she was in elementary school, and she went to Whiteman and to all the guys. But our kids, two of them are in Chicago now.
Which one?
Mark.
Is in Chicago?
And Danny. They're both working there in the health-related fields. Mark had been a vice president of marketing of an HMO. He's now starting his own health consulting business, and the other one works for an HMO in Chicago.
Health maintenance organization.
That's hospitalizations, big. I think. Yeah. And the middle kid, of all strange things, is a comedy writer, and he works for Jay Leno. He's under contract to NBC in Hollywood to write for Jay.
Eliano.
He fills in for Carson. He's a permanent guest host. And if he ever gets the show, I'm sure Stevie will go back. But in the meantime, Stevie has put two hitches in California. He was a road manager, and he worked for Jimmy Walker, the black comic. And he wrote for Rodney Dangerfield and Joan Rivers and stuff. But this Leno deal is the best because he's in the Writers Guild, and he gets a weekly check from NBC. And if Jay ever gets the show from Johnny Carson, I guess Stevie will go back to California. But in the meantime, he doesn't want him in California. Jay Leno has a very shrewd sense as a sidelight. He has four writers in California that are typical young, sharp-cut guys.